and it's 6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, latent haters, ineffectual intellectuals, festering progressives, men, children, women, girls, sexually confused people. How are you this morning? Dog people, cat people, fish people. Good morning, socialists, anarchists, adolescents, dope fiends and ex-dope fiends, and of course, those in possession of secret wisdom. Good morning to you, Mark Riley. He's got a big face full of secret wisdom today.
Oh, I don't know about secret. Not anymore.
He just blew a valve, man. He wants to see his boy Bernie Carrick crash and burn right there on the Daily News this morning. What's
front
it all about?
Front page, front page.
This guy was juggling two women, a contract
and his wife.
For the Taser company. He was doing everything.
And some questionable contacts with some waste management people that may have been connected with organized crime.
Really? Waste management in New York connected with organized crime?
Never. Perish the thought.
That seems crazy.
Well, hey, you know.
Hey, that's crazy,
Mark
Riley.
Who do you think coined the phrase cartage?
Yeah. It just seems crazy that you would think that organized crime is involved with waste management.
Well, that Bernie Carrick, a guy who was nominated for Homeland Security boss, would be involved with a cartage company with alleged ties to organized
crime. So this nanny thing's just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, this wasn't even the tip. This he bailed because he didn't want this stuff to start coming out. Multiple affairs.
How is it not going to come out? This is New York. I just saw the big New York smile of Mark Riley's, like, oh, we've been waiting for this.
Hey, see,
we always known this.
When he was first nominated, Mark, people in New York were saying, guys I knew in the reportage game here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, gee, don't they know about, and gee, don't they know about, and wow, they nominated him, don't they know about, and it was all kept very quiet until 8:30 p.m. Friday.
Well, you know, you got Giuliani apologizing to Bush. When was that, on Friday or on Sunday?
That was over
or,
the weekend,
right.
Yeah.
So he apologized to Bush, and, you know, he's making himself, like, who would have known that a thug would pick a dirty thug to be the police commissioner, you know what I mean? And the interesting commentary that, who was talking about it? Were you talking about it with me, about how, you know, that Giuliani created an environment for this guy to exist in this type of life?
Absolutely. And Joyce Pernick writes a very interesting article in today's New York Times that says that the climate that Rudy Giuliani created as mayor of this city, particularly during his second term, and this is instructive for George W. Bush, that climate, and remember that Carrick served during Giuliani's second term,
yeah,
that climate allowed Carrick to exist with all of these problems and never have to worry about those, because Giuliani used to use bully tactics with the press. He had a situation where he named the son of the boss of the Liberal Party to a job, and the guy messed up $250,000. All of these things were going on during Rudy Giuliani's second term as mayor, and now we see that Bernie Carrick was part and parcel of that and thought he could get by the White House and thought he could get into this Homeland Security gig because he never had to worry about anybody finding out about any of this stuff before now. It's amazing stuff. And by the way, this knocks one table leg out of Rudy Giuliani's aspirations for the presidency in 2008. He was hoping.
But he was only on two table legs.
Yeah, well, one of them's gone, and he may be falling over.
So he's just balancing that.
Well, yeah, because I don't care how many dinners he has with George W. Bush.
Yeah.
George W. Bush may forgive, but he never forgets, and there's no way in the world George W. Bush will now, unless it becomes overwhelming that Giuliani's going to be the nominee, Bush won't back him.
So this will be good. It'll just be like the old days, Giuliani and Carrick on the road at speaking engagements with Kerry, you know, carrying the
hey, Bernie, we're running
water,
out of gas.
The ex-mayor's water.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
We need to stop at a station, quick.
So, well, you know, also, he's the spokesperson for Taser.
That's how he made his fortune, remember?
Well, I think that's why they wanted him for Homeland Security. That's why Gonzalez is going to send him right through. He's like, this guy knows how to operate the right machinery. He's our guy.
Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general-to-be, was the person that vetted Bernie Carrick's resume in the White House. But, Mark, never mind all these nationals. Let's talk about Boston for a quick second.
Oh, yeah?
We had a ball in Boston.
Boston was good.
And I have to say, I've done this for 30 years.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
This was one of the finest remote broadcasts that has ever been my privilege to be associated with. I'm not saying that because we're on air. I said that before we got on the air.
Oh, it's great, man. It was great to be back up there. You know, it was great to see all the people come out. It was
people came out.
It was good fun. I'm still coming down from the coffee cake and the coffee. It was ridiculous.
It was was a lot of fun. We got some controversial stuff out of Barney Frank, which we'll be talking to one of our guests later this morning about.
Yeah, it's going to be, we're going to talk to the guy from actually from Eli Pariser, the executive director of Move On Pack.
Yeah.
He's going to talk about what he said about Terry
McAuliffe,
and then we'll play Barney Frank for him saying the opposite of what he said. Maybe we'll get into a little three-way craziness.
A little back and forth, a little of this and
a little
that.
Back and forth with just Barney Frank on tape, which is fine.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's all right. We've also got, who else we got coming up today? Fred Burks,
yeah.
He's a former high-level government interpreter who has refused to sign an oath of secrecy for the Bush administration.
And then quit.
Yep. And Jeff Jarvis, the editor of Buzz Machine, is going to talk to us about, anti-Semitism coming out of the Catholic spokesman.
You know, that was the most incredible piece of transcript that
yeah,
most
that
people will
O'Neill?
Never see.
Yeah,
Donahue.
I read that guy. I read that piece. It was like the transcript is baffling. I wish we'll find the sound by then because I didn't get to hear it as it was said. I just read the transcript, but it was pretty nasty.
It was nasty, but you know what struck me, Mark?
What?
If you look at the transcript, there seemed to be, now Buchanan was hosting this thing.
Yeah.
Remember, we've had Pat Buchanan on before. We had a testy exchange with him, but what the heck, we've had him on before. But
back at the very beginning.
He seemed not prepared to intercede. To say to Donahue, you know, what you're saying is anti-Semitic, man.
Yeah.
But we'll get into that. We'll get into that later this week.
It's hard to know what Pat was thinking because a lot of those hosts just let things go just so it gets crazy, you know. But
yeah,
you know, given his isolationist views and the idea that he's Pat Buchanan, you might think he had an ulterior motive, probably.
Yeah.
I saw him on McLaughlin Group last night. He behaved himself for the most part.
Well, he tries to come off as... I guess the voice. Well, they all try and come off a little suave on the McLaughlin.
Well, it's just like I'm no apologist for Pat Buchanan, but he's one of these guys that, you know, really started to trim his ideology to fit what's going on now, you know, in terms of outsourcing, in terms of isolationism. But, you know, he's still a bastard.
As opposed to what was going on in, like, 1950, which is where his philosophy was anchored up until pretty recently.
Right.
But never mind, Pat Buchanan. Let's talk about your gigs in Boston, man. The ding ho thing.
Oh, the
How'd
Boston.
How'd it go?
That was good, man. It was good. Me and Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman in New Jersey, Dan Pashman, went out to this gig over there at Jimmy Tingle Theater. There was about eight guys on, and Stephen Wright came by, and he did a set, and that was pretty great.
That must have been fun.
Well, yeah, he's a nice guy, you know, and he was real funny. Everyone's funny. Jack Gallagher, Tony V, Tingle was funny. Crimmins went on right at the beginning and
cool.
yelled at everybody. It was great. But he was very funny. But it was exciting to see Stephen Wright because I haven't seen him live ever, you know, and I've seen him around because he was in Boston. He lives up there. And, you know, he was sort of around. He kind of, like, he, all of a sudden you see him standing in the back somewhere, and then he disappears. He's a very quiet guy. But, yeah, he was funny, and he enjoyed my set, and we had a nice little chat, and everybody hung out. It was great to see those guys. It was like old home week in some weird way. I walked into Redbones that night on Thursday, and I saw all these cats that were like the top comics when I was coming up. They used to host open mics and stuff, and it was like, I almost cried. It was unbelievable.
And what were they all, like, sitting there in front of a, because Redbone's a rib joint, right?
I mean, I ate there twice, man. I ate there twice. The rib joint in a half. In Somerville. Oh, man, it's the best. It just is the best. They're like rib historians.
Really?
You know, like, they don't just do, like, most places where you go, like, the reason why barbecue places are great is because they do one thing a certain way. Like, you know, I love those ribs that they have at that place, and that place has great cornbread. That, you know, that's what makes it regional and interesting. But these guys, like, it's almost like they did the research and, you know, put all this stuff together. They got four different kinds of sauces. They got several different types of ribs, styles of ribs. It's almost like the history of barbecue. It was awesome. And then Saturday night I came back. I did the gig at Maxwell's for the Yolo Tango Hanukkah week, and I was a little tight, man. I was a little angry.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know what it is, man. Sometimes I perform for people of my own ilk, like, you know, just sort of, you know, 30 to 40-year-old ex-hipsters or current hipsters, you know, and sometimes I don't know whether it's my self-hatred or what it is, but I just look out at the sea of sort of, you know, German industrialist glasses and, you know, 40-year-olds dressed like 10-year-olds in 1973 and, you know, or, you know, hipsters, you know, Brooklyn hipsters dressed like hillbillies who look like they should be driving a tractor. It's just, I get to a certain point where I'm like, I don't want to open up to these people.
Wow.
You know, and like, you know me, man, I'm not an ironic cat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's not where my comedy goes. I'm not an irony guy, and I get my head all screwed up about, you know, what I think they want, what I should do. It was good, but, you know, I have two speeds. Either I can open my heart up and really talk to people and, you know, get on the same page, or I can be a little defensive and a little brooding and kind of dark, and it was more one of those nights.
Wait a minute, did somebody, like, heckle you or interrupt you?
Nobody did anything. It was just a guy
but
in my
you
head.
Jumped in
it, was,
anyway.
it was the heckler in my head, Riley.
Uh-oh.
It was the heckler in my head that said, you know, dude, you know, these people, but I work for these people all the time at Luna and everything else, and I don't know why I'm calling them these people. We're all the same. You know, it's just a very interesting thing because I've noticed it, that with people that are more like me, I tend to get more defensive because I, you know, like I got dirty and I wanted to talk some dirty stuff because I think, like, sometimes, you know, I look at, like, the hipsters, it's like, let's, you know, I want to talk about sex just because they're, they don't want to talk about it. They think they're above it or they don't want to acknowledge that part of themselves so much, you know.
Well, they don't do it.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what other people are doing. You know, I just, like, I felt a little tight, but it was still a good show, and Yellow Tango was great, and 11th Dream Day, who I hadn't seen in years. I was big fans of that band, and they've been around since the late 80s, or the mid-80s. I think I picked up on them in the late 80s, and they were just awesome. It was great to see, you know, sort of grown people, you know, playing real music, you know, with a lot of heart and a lot of, it was a great show. You know, I just felt a little defensive during my part of it. So when we come back, let's get into Iraq. Let's get into intelligence reform. Let's get into El Baradei, the guy from the International Atomic Energy Commission.
International Atomic Energy Agency. And yeah, everybody thought Kofi Annan was the only person that people eavesdropped on.
Yeah. Not hardly.
Yeah, so they're chasing this guy down now. It's 17 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online at morningsedition.com from Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio. It's Monday. Man, I got, why do I keep saying dude? Why did I pick up that habit, man? I didn't always have that habit. Is it some on-the-air habit? What the hell?
So I'm, you know, there was a whole story about the word dude.
I know, that guy ripped it off from Schneider, from Rob Schneider. What is it? Rob Schneider, the comic?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, the guy from SNL, he did a dude bit years ago. That was exactly that, what that researcher did his research on, about the different uses of the word dude. Well, I'm going to pull back from it right now. Also, this morning, man, 11:30, I go to bed, you know, last night, getting ready for the Monday show, trying to make the big shift from my weekend hours to the week hours. And one of those car alarms went off, the old school
car alarm.
The horn, just the horn. And the type of anger I have immediately, dude, I am ready to go get eggs. I'm ready to go down there. One time, I almost took a bat and went down and just, you know, broke the windshield of the car because there's nothing you can
do
about it.
Just to make it worthwhile, right?
Well, there's nothing you can do about it if no one does anything about it. And I've called the cops before, and they come and they go, yeah, it's going off. All right, great. Try it. So, Kalo, how you doing, man?
All right.
You're all right. Our board out there, I forgot to give a shout out on the air from Boston. Did a great job.
He did do a great job.
Thank you.
Kayla.
Any truth to the mob being involved with the waste disposal industry?
I don't know what you're talking about. And
come on, you're from Staten Island. Come on, you must know something.
I think we should move on.
Yeah, good idea.
Yeah. All right, so here's the deal. Apparently, the Bush administration has dozens of intercepts of Mohammed El-Baradei's phone calls with Iranian diplomats and is scrutinizing them in search of ammunition to oust him as the director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And this is coming from three U.S. government officials. What do you think of that?
Well,
they're trying to push this guy out because he didn't play ball with the Bush administration, just like everybody else who doesn't play ball with the Bush administration.
He was one of the earliest people to question U.S. intelligence about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
That makes him suspect. And, of course, the fact that he works for an agency that's sponsored by the U.N. makes him doubly suspect. So now the Bush administration, and the Bush administration understands very clearly that in America, most people don't know who Mohammed El-Baradei is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to be like, you know, his going, you know, the United States going after him is going to create some groundswell of anger here in this country. Nobody cares.
Yeah, except for those, you know, diehard fans of El-Baradei. You know, the guys who, you know, are on the El-Baradei website, the fan sites and the chat boards. A lot of people always talking like, man, El-Baradei, he's crazy.
Yeah, his website, elbaradei.com.
Yeah, very exciting. So apparently eavesdropping, even on allies, is considered a well-worn tool of national security and diplomacy. The efforts against this guy demonstrate the length some within the administration are willing to go to replace a top international diplomat who questioned U.S. intelligence on Iraq. And that's basically the deal. So now let's talk about this new intelligence czar, because there's some issue as to, like, you know, I guess in the past, the CIA director dealt directly with the president. So now they're trying to figure out, you know, who is going to brief the president and how this, what's the reciprocity there?
You know, we used to do a bit called the Presidential Daily Briefing.
Yeah, we still do.
Okay, well, there used to be a Presidential Daily Briefing by the Director
right.
of Central Intelligence.
Right.
Now, this legislation creating a new intel czar calls into question who will be briefing the president on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And the conventional wisdom seems to be not Porter Goss, assuming that he remains as CIA director. It may well be this new intelligence czar,
yeah.
who, by the way, Goss, as CIA director, would be reporting to.
Right.
So it looks like there may be someone else doing this.
Why do I still get excited that the idea that Goss, you know, had to take sort of a drop in ranking? I get very excited about that.
Well, it's not a done deal yet. He could still end up being
the intelligence czar.
It doesn't look likely, but he still could end up being intelligence czar. But see, the other thing is
mm-hmm.
that they're looking to possibly institute some form of brain drain from some of the other intelligence agencies, like the NSA, the National Security Agency, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. According to MSNBC, the authors of this reform bill hope that top analysts from the CIA and other agencies will stay at these new centers that the bill empowers the new guy to create. So
right.
these will be newly created centers of intelligence. And apparently they're going to recruit from existing agencies, which is always a touchy subject, you know.
Right.
You know, you're stealing away maybe some of these other agencies, the NSA's best people.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're in a situation where this guy will control this whole center of intelligence, and there will be a lot of money put into these centers, and there will be a lot of intelligence collating going through these agencies.
And they're going to have to deal with the National the Homeland Security Director, too, who I think now is going to be, I think John Gotti's son is in the running. Am I wrong?
No, he's busy putting up drywall at the MoMA.
that's an interesting story.
Yeah, there's an allegation. It's in the local papers here, but at any rate.
We're going to the MoMA this week. Chris, when can you go, man? Can you go tomorrow?
Yes, through Tuesday.
What's your Tuesday? Me and Kalo and Riley,
going.
You
I'm going to go.
The Colonel, Kent the Colonel Jones is going to come.
Now, for those of you outside New York, MoMA is the Museum of Modern Art. It's just been relocated to its old home in a new home on the West 50s in Manhattan.
I'm psyched.
It had been out in Long Island City in Queens for a while. It had a gigantic opening, people wrapped around the block. So we waited until all the hoopla was done, and now we're going to go check it out.
We're going to check it out, and we're going to mic ourselves up, and we're going to move through the MoMA.
There you go.
So when we come back, let's talk about Iraq, and we got... we're going to talk about the recounts at the top of the hour, and we're going to talk to our guest who is coming up. That's Fred Burke, a former high level government. Oh, there he is. Okay.
Somebody slid something under the door,
again?
And it says from George.
All right. Well,
I don't know which George it is.
All right.
We'll get to that when we come back here on Air America Radio.
On Air America Radio.
Hey, that's it. 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition.
Good morning.
You're listening to Air America Radio. Ramon just came by and he waved to me from where Wayne sits over there in the booth. He slid the palm pilot under the door and he was wearing sweats. So, and I guess there's a new momentum in the White House because apparently Bush has gotten a little chunky.
Yeah.
And, you know, being a vain, narcissistic, selfish person, the idea of being a little chunky has got to be eaten at him because he says, quote, my New Year's resolution has become apparent after getting on the scale. Bush said, quote, I'm a little overweight, therefore I fully intend to lose some inches off my waistline and some pounds off my frame. He went to a doctor, and apparently they removed a couple of moles or something.
Lesions, they call them.
What they are, did you ever see How to Get Ahead in Advertising? What they're not lesions. They're these little crying heads that represent Bush's conscience of what he's repressing. So, like, he knows he's getting one of these lesions when he hears it, like, oh, why are you doing this to the world? Why? I got to get that removed. Brendan P.W. McDonald back. He's back from a family vacation in Florida where he... what did you say? He was in Orlando. He said, did you see Mickey Mouse? He said, yeah, I saw all those bastards. I don't think he used that terminology. I saw all those. All of them. Dumpy and grumpy. There's no dumpy, is there?
I don't know.
Dumpy.
I thought he'd come back with some souvenir ears for all of us.
Dwarf. Huh?
I thought he'd come back with some souvenir mouse ears for all of us.
Did you get him a present?
For where? Boston?
Well, yeah, wherever.
We can get them the Somerville pin.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll give you an Air America keychain. We have a few left over, right, Brendan?
A couple of those lovely snappy pens that we were giving away.
So let's read George W. Bush's pomp pile this morning. This is the president's schedule. 6 a.m., wake up. Immediately step on scales, 199.6 pounds. Too many campaign donuts. I'm hideous. No one will ever love me now. 6:30 a.m., breakfast, laxative omelet and Diet Coke. 6:45 a.m. to 7:45 a.m., bathroom time. I'm hideous. No one will ever love me now. 7:50 a.m., weigh-in, 199.7 pounds. How did that happen? Fire someone. 7:53 a.m., purge. Note, I wonder if I can still fit into that flight suit. 7:55 a.m., burn flight suit. 10 a.m., call Putin about Ukrainian election crisis. Note, he's so thin. How does he do it? 10:15 a.m., purge. 1 p.m., find some excuse to meet with Colin Powell just to feel better about my weight. 2 to 9 p.m., jog on treadmill in steam room. Declare war on donuts. 9:10 p.m., purge. Weigh in, 199.8 pounds. Oh, no, I'm hideous. No one will love me now.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
What exactly is a laxative omelet?
I don't know. I think what you do is you put a little brand in there, a little senna, a little cascara sagrada.
That's the organic stuff.
Dude, that stuff is nasty. Wow. I gotta quit saying, dude, how do I extract that? I think I got rid of the anyways, you know, but I still got likes and dudes to reckon with.
Not to worry about it. It'll flush out of your system, sort of like
I'm very, very self-critical these days. You know why? I got a lot of time on my hands.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, sitting around thinking all the time. Thinking. So, here we go. Let's move into Iraq. Let's do this. Apparently, you know, the blaming of the reporter for the Sergeant Wilson's, you know, question to Donald Rumsfeld, it's ridiculous because we talked about this before. Mm-hmm. You know what's really sad is that reporters have to use military tactics to ask their leaders questions that they deserve answers to. And the idea that he, you know, has been embedded with these Marines for this time, he has a relationship with them, and a suggestion to try and get to the bottom of something that concerns those guys directly, you know, shouldn't be anything. You know, I know that this thing was sent up as a trial balloon to try and make, you know, to make Wilson, the sergeant, look bad. But it's not working. It has no effect.
It has no effect, and it's caused, Mark, a chain reaction in terms of, you know, some of the companies that produce the armor that supplements these Humvees as to whether or not they were operating at capacity. The Defense Department has said a couple of them were, when in fact they were not. And whether or not they could turn them out fast enough to fully equip the armed forces over there. The Defense Department says it's going to take a long time. The same people that make this stuff say not as long as the Defense Department says.
Uh-huh.
It's incredible. I mean,
this is all about money. This is about, Rumsfeld, the neocon dirtbag, being a penny pincher and making guys die because he's not willing to, you know, get behind it with the right amount of money. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, that's part of it. And the other thing is, when did Rumsfeld actually have access to the information about this problem? Because apparently in November of 2003, perhaps?
Yeah.
I believe it was in November of 2003, someone tried to get an audience with Rumsfeld to warn him about this very problem, and he was told, make an appointment.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for at least that long, since we've been on the air.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking about the lack of military armor that, you know, over there, even in the terms of the flak jackets.
Yeah.
You know, this has been going on a long time.
It's been going on too long, and it's obvious now that no matter how many right-wing attack dogs they put out to try and discredit the reporter, the substance of the question remains unanswered.
It's got teeth.
It's got teeth.
It's got legs.
Rumsfeld has not answered it to the satisfaction of many Republicans in Congress.
Well, that's because it's impossible to understand his answers.
Yeah.
You know, they all convolute each other. They fall back in on themselves, and you can't understand what the hell he's saying. He's a real pro at subterfuge. Is that what that's called?
Well, that's what it's called, and particularly that thing about the army that you don't get the army that you want, you get the army that you have, or something like that.
Well, that was pretty bad, but how about the other thing? It's like, you know, even if you're in a tank, you can still get blown up.
Yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Okay, you're right. You know, that's stupid for me to ask. It's war, and we could all die, and why even bother wearing clothes? Let's just go run out there naked. If there's enough of us, maybe someone will get through, and we can just pee on them.
Well, now let's look at exactly what's going on here. Donald Rumsfeld is saying that, and this is a quote from his response to the question by Tom, it's essentially a matter of physics. It isn't a matter of money. It isn't a matter on the part of the army of desire. It's a matter of production and capability of doing it. Well, former Congress member Matt Salmon, who's a consultant for Armor Works of Tempe, Arizona, who makes this armor, says that's not the case, at least not in the case of his company. He has a $30 million contract to provide these armor kits that are fitted onto Humvees, and he says, and this is a quote, the Pentagon right now in its post-debacle spin is trying to convince everyone that contractors are operating at peak capacity. In our case, it's flat out not accurate.
So this is part of it. It's all falling under the neocon death cult's blame dispersal unit. So no one's going to take responsibility for this thing. It's just going to go around and go around until it sort of dissipates and spins off into the ether. Yet still, you know, there are 1,200 plus soldiers dead in Iraq. You know, there are 30,000 that are coming home without legs, you know, with mental problems or injured in some other way, legs, arms, fingers. And there's, you know, now, you know, upwards of 100,000 dead Iraqis, and no one's willing to take responsibility for you know, who's responsible for this issue, this problem.
You know what's interesting about this story?
What?
John McCain is going to weigh in on it, because guess where this guy is from? Guess where this armor works company is?
Arizona.
His state. He will speak up on this issue, and he's going to criticize the Bush administration, and specifically Rumsfeld, who he's got a problem with anyway.
Well, I think there's a tremendous opportunity in reality television right now. Not reality television, but I think Jesse James and the Monster Garage crew should go to Iraq, go to these scrap heaps, get some Humvees. Let's make one a giant pig, you know, big armored pig, and just drive it right through. Let's scare the insurgents. Let's scare them on a propaganda level.
We can scare them.
Yeah.
We've got a year's worth of dealing with these people, and one thing we know about them is they don't scare. They just don't, all right?
But at least, you know, it can be, you know, it'd be exciting, because right now, you know, this hillbilly armor element where they're just, you know, they're rigging these Humvees.
The like, Mad Max
effect. Yeah, like Road Warrior, you know. I mean, I think there's an opportunity for some interesting television for Jesse James to, you know, get out there and help any way he can. I'd love to see this guy just put those welder. Here we go. We've got 24 hours to make this Humvee a giant boob. Hey,
this is what's being called the ugly reality of wartime Iraq. It's an ugly reality that Rumsfeld, on the part of the Bush administration, has been unwilling and unable to face until now.
How about this quick story? What a sad bit of business this is. This 19-year-old, Marine Lance Captain David Battle, learned, you know, he'd either have to sacrifice his ring finger or his wedding ring. You know,
I mean.
So speculate. What do you think he did? We'll be back in a second at Air America Radio 43,000.
Morning Sedition, your daily wake up call to arms on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's nice to see Brendan P.W. McDonald's head back in the booth next to Larson. Clutch Larson, or as I'm going to call him, Napoleon from here on out. Napoleon. Yeah, because I think as he keeps losing weight on Weight Watchers, he's actually going to get shorter. And he's just going to keep getting smaller and smaller until he's going to be this weird, ineffectual little man in pants that are too big going, wait, it's my show, hey. And then he'll just disappear onto his chair, and then we'll be like, what happened to Larson? I don't know, he's right there. And then you'll turn on your computer, and he'll be in there going, help me, let me out, I'm on the blog, trying to make the blog entry at the beginning. Look, I'm doing it by hand, it's a marquee. You just see him, like, you know, on the blog. With a little, like, putting up marquee letters, like, hey, today, what's the cute little clever topic for today? Today will be fat. Yeah, that'll be the cute topic at the beginning. Anyways, here we go. So, Marine, I'm sorry, buddy, you didn't deserve that, did you? Did you, Jonathan? You've been nothing but good. It's been nothing but fun.
He's talking to me.
Yes, that's true, what he said in my head that I won't share with you, because I can't even stand to hear him put himself down. I'd rather be the one to do that. Marine Lance Corporal David Battle learned that he'd either have to sacrifice his ring finger or the wedding band he wore on that finger. He told doctors at the field hospital in Iraq to cut off the finger, man. My wife's too good a woman to have to go through that. So they cut off his ring thing. He cut off his finger, pulled the ring off, and then in some sort of, you know, chaos, they lost the ring.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Well, apparently his wife still appreciated the gesture, obviously, but, you know, fortunately he was able to keep his finger and send that back to his wife.
Yeah, he was, his hand was badly mangled, apparently.
No, I'm making a bad joke. Yes, it was. It's a very touching story, but it's not, I don't think it's medical incompetence, but somebody lost the ring.
Ring, yeah, yeah.
It's a sad story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although the wife was, you know, like completely impressed. I mean, just said, you know, what a wonderful guy he was.
Yeah. Yeah. But now, you know, now there's going to be the funny nicknames and fights. You know what I mean? There's no end to where that's going to go. So apparently a lot of Iraqis don't have any understanding about how an election works.
Yeah, and I don't know how much this should surprise people, but the Iraqis are really confused with 7 weeks to go until this election actually takes place.
Mm.
They are trying to reach out. They have an independent electoral commission that's trying to reach out to the potential voters there, some 14 million strong. Want to let them know about how the process works, generate some enthusiasm for it, because it really hasn't been a proper election since the late 1950s. The UN helped form this commission back in May, but you know, the idea that a country or a people have lost their, you know, how to do democracy over 5 decades is not a great leap.
Well, the people that, you know, there's going to be a lot of people coming out to vote, you know, especially like, you know, the 60% of the country that is Shiite are being, you know, ordered to vote by their guy. And it's going to be interesting because when Iraq changes its name to Sistani Land,
yeah,
that's going to be a whole different game there.
Named after Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who actually issued a fatwa saying that all Shiites, and of course Shiites make up about 60% of the population, must come out to vote. But what's interesting about this is that with 230 political parties, Sistani hasn't told them who to vote for yet.
Yeah.
Now,
that's because he hasn't announced he's running. How many political parties? There's like 200.
230 parties registered.
What does that mean, man? Is there one guy that's just like, this is the party of Ahmed's party?
What it means is that many of these parties will form into coalitions that will try and contest as a group.
But what could 200 parties be? Is there the party of what? People who, I don't understand. What? How could there be that many parties?
There are bunches and bunches of different Shia parties, as one example.
But are they just different by name? Are they different by, like, we do not wear those shoes?
Well, yeah, and probably some differences in political philosophy. And remember, too, and you're the one that has brought this up consistently.
We tie our tunics differently.
No, yeah. A lot of it's tribal.
Yeah.
A lot of it is...
Okay, that makes sense. So yeah. It's a familial thing.
Yeah, it's a familial thing. They're representatives of certain tribes. They may all practice, you know, so the Sunni version of Islam or the Shia version of Islam or even some of the Kurds.
Mm-hmm.
But they come together and they, you know, they form these different political parties. And the next step now, if there was more time to do this, would be for these different parties from these different tribal groups to coalesce and maybe make, 28, 30 different parties that are based around coalitions of, for example, 10 each or something along those lines.
But like I told you before the show, I was watching television last night and I saw some footage of Sistani just sitting there being the sort of, you know, old cleric that he is. And he was exuding something that made me realize, like, oh, my God, it's all about this guy.
He's the grand, high, exalted, mystic ruler.
Right. He's the guy that's, he's going to sway this whole thing. And he's been sort of playing it that way the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't heard nothing about the rock and roll sheik. What's his name?
Al-Sadr.
Yeah, Al-Sadr. Where's that guy? Where's that loudmouth been?
Al-Sadr has been contemplating whether or not to actually back one. I think
align
he
himself
is backing,
with Sistani?
Yeah. No, not so much align himself with Sistani, but align himself with one or more of these 230 different parties. I believe that there are a couple of them that have substantial numbers of his supporters in them.
Mm-hmm.
But he hasn't, any more than Sistani, he has not officially decided to back anybody yet. But believe me, the United States, unlike what they tried to do with Al-Sadr, unsuccessfully, by the way, but they are and have in the past tried to court Sistani because he is by far the most popular cleric in the country. He is revered by the Shia, and you know the United States can ill afford at this point to alienate all of the Shiites.
So you want to talk about Social Security a little?
Sure.
Well, we got a couple minutes. We can cover it later in the show as well.
Yeah, we're going to do that later on in the show. But so, you know, the Social Security thing, I won't say it's starting to, the wheels are starting to come off, but there are some important Republicans who say that Bush has some serious obstacles in putting in getting this plan
done. Yeah, because they're like, you know, you want to do what? You want to spend $1 trillion to $2 trillion on what?
Yeah.
I mean, what, you know, how is that not? These guys are supposed to be the guys that don't expand government. This thing would expand government tremendously.
It would expand government tremendously. And remember, the surplus right now, or actually the total in the trust fund, I shouldn't say the surplus, the total in the trust fund right now is $1.5 trillion.
Yeah.
So, you know, and people are now starting to argue about the same kind of figures that we talked about with David K. Johnson the other day, last week, about exactly how much this is going to cost. It'll be $1 trillion or $2 trillion. There's a little bit of a difference there. And also, whether or not the system is in as dire shape as the Republicans have portrayed it until now.
Let's hear a clip of David K. Johnson. He was on our show last week on, was it Thursday? But
yeah.
Let's hear number one, Chris.
Here's a simple question. Why do we need a big new government program that will generate all these fees for brokers on Wall Street? Why not simply say, here's your 4 percentage points. You can keep an extra $1,000 a year from Social Security, and you can save it for the future, and you can invest it if you want. You can go spend it. And if you do, well, when you're old and you're hungry and out on the street, we don't care.
Right. But instead, let's let the government invest it for you. So where are we going to put that money?
Hello, seven.
It's black. Oh, no. Sorry. Yeah, we're going to lose that. In order for Bush to get Social Security privatized, he must convince the public that the system is in imminent danger of collapse and that we must destroy Social Security in order to save it, which isn't true. However, the system is not in imminent danger. If we don't make a single change to Social Security, the system will remain fully funded and benefits will be fully paid until 2052. Even after 2052, the system won't go bankrupt. It will still be able to pay out 81% of promised benefits. In other words, there is a problem with Social Security, but it's a small problem that calls for some tweaking, not a large problem that calls for a massive government program costing $1 to $2 trillion. Paul Krugman says, very little about the privatizer's position is honest. They come to bury Social Security, not to save it. They aren't sincerely concerned about the possibility that the system will someday fail. They're disturbed by the system's historic success. Social Security is a government program that works, a demonstration that a modest amount of taxing and spending can make people's lives better and more secure, and that's why the right wants to destroy it. I will repeat that later. This is important stuff. Here's the liberal agenda for today from the Streisand Compound. Write these down. One, new nicknames for Bush. Commander in Cheese, Engorge Bush, and Blubbia. Two, participate in Living Nativity Scene as Joseph and Mary's brother-in-law, Ricky, from Sherman Oaks. Three, secretly replace nearest plaque of the Ten Commandments with George Carlin's seven words you can't say on television. Hire Ocean's 12 to steal enough money to repay the deficit. Five, today's phrase is drop it into conversation. Hey, Bush, when's the baby due, huh, Porky? I didn't know Taft was still president. Taft, yeah.
Ooh.
Taft, you know, fat, big Taft.
Oh, you're unconscious. We'll be right back with Fred Burks. He's a former high-level government interpreter. He's going to tell us why he quit when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Maron. You're listening to Air America Radio at 6 past the hour. And this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, festering, progressive, ineffectual, intellectuals, latent haters, the narrow-minded, self-righteous man, children, women, girls, androgynous helpers of animals. Hello. Good morning to you. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
How's it going, man?
What's up?
Could not give my cat away. Could not give the meanie away. Could not. No, I just couldn't. I couldn't bring myself to bring him over there. I'm going to bring her over there. I'm going to bring him
Is
over.
Is this to the shop owner?
I'm going to bring him over to the shop owner. I just can't. I haven't been able to deal with it. And then
really?
They're all laying there on the couch all together. You know, all four of them all in a little cat ball. I'm so attached even to these cats that don't even like me. I like having them around. I like looking at them. You know, that's what my life's become.
Well, hey, you know, I mean,
ain't bad.
They're hanging out together.
Yeah.
You know, because I've seen cats kind of like, you know, fold all up into each other.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like spooning with humans.
I guess. Yeah, I know. But then I go near them and they scatter into a little cat explosion.
Really?
No! that's the man we see every day but still can't accept. You know,
this is when you really need your dead cat Butch to give him a little guidance.
Some of my listeners are like that. No, that's the man we hear every day but we can't accept. So let's get into this. There is a pretty profound, like a lot of money, a lot of people, a lot of grassroots organizing has led to some real action going on in Ohio. Obviously the recounts are going to happen, and obviously, you know, hopefully they will not count the electoral votes until these recounts happen. There's a couple coalitions, you know, trying to get that done. There's a We Do Not Concede, which is an activist group that came after the election, that believes that Kerry is the real winner in Ohio and nationally, and that they are going to keep pressuring to not get those electoral votes counted. There's also the Citizens Alliances for Secure Elections and a few others that just demand that the electoral vote just be put off until a recount is completed. Not all of these groups feel that Kerry is necessarily the true winner, but as we do here and as all of us really feel that unless these things are done, you know, we're not going to get a proper election system. And unless the election system is federalized, unless maybe they get rid of the Electoral College. I mean, the bottom line is even John Kerry has conceded, and he conceded too early, but he's come out in support of the recount last week, yet he's not, I've been pretty disappointed with his presence in this whole process. But out of all of this, you know, if we stay on top of these, there's a recount going on in Washington as well in the gubernatorial election.
Washington State.
Yes.
Yeah.
That there has to be, you know, a federalized election system. There has to be a more effective way to do this. I think that if there was any fraud, that it obviously traces right up to the top at these machine companies, that is going to be, you know, difficult to prove, but perhaps will be proven. Hopefully it will. But if it isn't fraud and just politics and dirty politics at that, because the dissidents, as they call in this piece, which is not, that's not what they are. The activists claim there were disparities in vote totals for Democrats, too few voting machines in Democratic-leaning precincts, organized campaigns directing voters to the wrong polling place, and confusion over counting of provisional ballots by voters whose names did not appear in the books of polling places. This is all dirty politics.
Of course it's dirty politics. And the first step, Mark, is going to have to be some national standard for the machines themselves, all right? Because at this point, it's going to be a long, torturous process to get the states to agree to overall federal monitoring of the elections on a state level. But the first step is to say to people there must be a standard below which you cannot use a voting machine. If it doesn't have a paper trail, can't use it. I don't care how technologically advanced it's supposed to be.
These systems have remained, complex. They've been used by both parties over the years.
Absolutely.
The way that the system is organized and disorganized at the same time allows for a certain amount of error every election. No matter how many times they recount any of these things, the numbers is going to be different. They certainly shouldn't be off by 40,000. That's the liability of using machines with no paper trails, obviously. But, you know, the need to get some election system, some system of counting the votes that is, you know, at least effective to, you know, a couple of hundred votes. I mean, I don't understand that. It seems that when it comes to money, you know, with ATM machines, they never lose a cent unless you're lucky.
You know, you
get a few hundred bucks, but you know, for some reason, they can't make this effective. And with a paper trail that will enable at least 99.9% of the votes to be counted properly, it's just ridiculous to me. And hopefully, all this action will move us towards that and move us towards at least having effective machine, like the presence of voting machines in. That was very devious politics to understaff and under, you know, and have fewer polling machines, you know, when there were some sitting in warehouses in neighborhoods where that were densely populated by poor voters, by African American voters, by people who are off the grid, mm-hmm. you know, and just to stilt it so those people who they knew would vote for Kerry couldn't vote effectively at all.
See, this is where you have to start, because it has been on the state, county, and municipal level where these elections and this sort of foolishness has gone on. I mean, there were allegations here in New York, for example, with the 40-year-old machines that are used here, that at one time you could jack up the machine totals before they ever left the warehouse, so that you put certain people having certain numbers of votes before anyone had actually cast a ballot.
Right.
There are other situations across the country. There are too many of these kinds of irregularities and potential for irregularities for it to continue to be left on the local level. You must have some uniformity or uniform standard. You know, we have uniform federal standards for almost everything. Why not for voting?
Because then you can't skewer it.
You know, you have uniform standards for cars, right?
Skewer.
Skew. Yeah, well, I mean, you can skew the election. I mean, look, there's always going to be somebody trying to skew the election results. There's always going to be somebody that thinks they can trick this particular system because they figure people aren't really paying that close attention. Now, the thing about the protest today, because the electors in Ohio are due to certify this thing today. This is when they're supposed to be getting the job done in Ohio. And the fact is that there's going to be a protest. And these are people who say now part of this coalition are the Green and Libertarian parties. And they're actually putting their money where their mouths are because they are paying for recounts. And they're simply saying, don't let the electors certify until the recount is done.
This is a lot of people's money. This has been the power of the mobilization through some of these voting organizations that, we've had links to our sites on morningsedition.com. Mm-hmm. Deb Harris and her people and some other people have really pulled people together in getting the money to do this. This is like the sort of undramatic action of real democracy taking place, beneath our eyes here, is that, people are fighting to get this thing, counted properly and to reframe electoral politics.
Of course. And now here's the process in Ohio. The electors are going to be in the Senate chamber this morning. They're going to cast vote. I'm sorry, today. And they're going to cast votes for president, then vice president. They're going to be on separate, ironically enough, paper ballots.
Mm-hmm.
The ballots are counted by representatives of Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell. That's Secretary of State / chair, state campaign chair of the Bush-Cheney reelection. Let's be clear about that. And then they're handed to Blackwell, and he's the presiding officer of the electoral vote. He will sign a transmittal of the vote total, and he sends it to the president of the U.S. Senate, and that nationwide total will be announced on January 6th.
Well, we'll see what happens today. We'll be talking about it tomorrow.
Yeah.
If you want to pipe in on this, 866-303-2270 is our number. Call us with what's on your mind and what information you have. And we'll be talking about the Democratic National Committee chair after this. It's 14 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Join the Morning Sedition. Call 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America. America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition.
Good morning.
You're listening to Air America Radio. Thank you for all your calls. They're coming in. Keep calling. If you want 866-303-2270, we're going to get to you in just a second. But right now, I will share my dream from last night. Hopefully, I can go to therapy this week. This is getting ridiculous. So I'm in Boston walking along the street in Somerville, and I pass this guy on the sidewalk with his hands crammed into a long overcoat, wearing a little cap and muttering to himself. Oh, my God, it's me. Only it's me 15 years ago. I stop and say, sorry, but don't I know you, man? And he looks up at me. He looks up at me and he says, what the f***, man? Get your hands off me, douchebag. I say, but it's me, man. You, 15 years from now. He says, what, I owe you money or something? Because I don't have it, man. I say, come on, dude. Let me buy you lunch. He studies my face for a minute and says, so you're me 15 years from now, huh? Well, at least you're not fat. I couldn't take that, man. So we're having lunch in between bites of cheesecake. He says, so I make it past 40, huh? That means nobody kills me. I don't kill myself. I say, look, things are okay, man. I've got a beautiful wife and a radio show that's on nationwide. He says, what do you want, a medal? You come here to rub that crap in my face? Who sent you here? Who are you working for? I don't have your money, okay? I say, dude, calm down. I just want to tell you that things are sort of, they sort of work out. All right? I even stopped drinking. He says, yeah, I can tell. You're really boring. So this radio thing, what are you, like the wacky morning zoo guy? I say, yeah, I'm on the morning smartass, but it's on this new liberal talk radio network. We're working hard to stick it to President Bush. He says, you mean that dude who puked on the Japanese prime minister that time? That Bush? I say, no, man, his son, Junior Bush, and it's his second term, total nightmare. He says, dude, you're killing me. George Bush Jr. is president, and you're not drinking? Wow. I say, yeah, it's a weird time. Sometimes I miss being you. He says, you still listen to AC/DC? I say, hey, man, I'm not dead. So me and my former self got in my rented Toyota Camry, and we drove around Boston all night listening to Back in Black.
Sweet. There you go.
I woke up, and my bed was filled with home fries.
Oh, right.
I did that. Sue, listening to WXXM in Wisconsin. Good morning, Sue.
Hi, Sue.
Morning.
How are you?
Doing all right.
How's everything in Wisconsin?
Cold and windy.
Oh, yeah. What's on your mind, Sue?
Big they got to win. They've got to make this happen in Ohio.
Yeah.
It's so much bigger than who gets into the White House.
Right.
It is the sanctity of the vote.
Yeah.
And if people cannot rely on the integrity of the electoral process, then what have we got?
That's right. Do you think it's ever been fair, Sue?
Do I think it's what?
Do you think it's ever been fair, the vote? I mean, you know,
I think it's been less unfair than other times.
Yeah, right now,
they're just sticking it to us real good.
That's for sure. Well, yeah, we hope so, too. I'm going to get out some websites right now, and you know, we'll see what happens by the end of the day. Thanks for your call.
Thanks,
okay.
Sue.
Groups organizing in Ohio, you can go to www.donotconcede.com, www.caseohio.org, www.51capitalmarch.com, www.redefeatbush.org, TrueBlueUS.org, and truthinvoting.org. We'll have links to those on our site. Dan in San Francisco listening to The Quake.
Hey, Dan.
Hey.
What's
How
up,
you doing, man?
It's dark out here.
Yeah. Still dark here.
Hey, I was calling you. Watch the news. I was looking in the papers about it. There was a lawsuit out here. You know, Bev Harris and another guy, they sued Diebold out here. And
right.
The whistleblower deal.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to settle on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Friday.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen nothing about it.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything about it either.
I've been having people write to our attorney general, Lockyer. He joined the suit on behalf of a couple counties here. And
it was more than a couple, wasn't it? I thought it was a pretty good number.
Well, it was Kern, San Joaquin, San Diego, Alameda, which is where Oakland is, Plumas, and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It was the biggest lawsuit in voting stuff ever. The only reason they didn't sue him under a crime is they caught him before it happened.
Uh-huh.
And back in when Arnold got voted in, I went to the, you know, that's when they first used the electronic thing, and I went in there and I said, hold it, this ain't right, you know?
Yeah.
So ever since, and a lot of people in California did this, we used the absentee ballot. But
that's what I did.
I still went down and put it in the box, you know? But
yeah.
600,000 people voted in my county, and 250,000 of them used the absentee ballot.
Just out of fear.
Yeah, exactly, because this is the land of programmers, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, the weird thing is like there's a million ways that these votes can be, you know, miscounted. You know, and the one thing that should be credible is the damn machine. I have no idea. You know, we were talking about this before the election. Beth Harris was talking about it almost up to, you know, a year, you know, before the election. This stuff was out there, and yet, you know, nothing was able to be done. Hopefully all these protests and everything that's going on right now can certainly get, you know, get us a machine with some credibility. I mean, there's a million ways for these things to go wrong. I mean,
I'll tell you what.
Counts, you know.
These guys have so much hubris, they don't care.
Yeah, of course they don't care.
You know they don't.
Yeah.
And you were asking the lady, what do you think is going to happen before? I don't know. The Second Amendment still applies, you know, but we hope it doesn't go to that. But
right.
I just don't feel that, you know, maybe we see it a little different in the West, you know, but
nobody
messes with your vote.
Well, you know, if the right to bear arms is meant to, you know, to allow us to rise up against our government, we're going to need bigger arms.
Yeah, right.
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't think the guys in Iraq will have a beef with it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Thanks a lot for your call,
man. Thanks for calling. You know, Dan makes
nice
an interesting
you,
point. Because the electors in Ohio are not using any machines.
Mm-hmm.
They're using a paper ballot to decide who's going to be who they're going to support in the Electoral College for president and vice president.
But the whole issue comes, too, with, you know, even with paper ballots, even with raising your hands, you know, you got human beings counting this stuff. It's always going to come out different. You know, you got groups of people counting millions of votes. Every vote's going to come out different. But the problem is with a machine with no paper trail, for there to be a 3,000 or 4,000 or 8,000 or 10,000 vote difference, that's ridiculous. Whether it's an accident, whether it's a glitch, or whether it's planned, there just has to be a paper trail, and there needs to be some sort of federalized system.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Let's talk to David. David in Florida, listening to WINZ. Good morning.
Hi, David.
Good morning, Mark and Mark. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, sir.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I figured out the Rumsfeld thing.
Okay.
There's a huge security company.
Yeah.
I won't even say their name. It's so big they run prisons.
Wackenhut?
That's the one.
Okay.
They're so big that if you want to work with them, you have to provide your own car. You can't just show up to jobs in a taxi or a bus. You have to bring your own stuff. So the Army is becoming like that, whether it's bring your own vest, bring your own stick on armor, the whole deal. So
you're saying
this is nothing new.
Yeah, you're on your own. Yeah, yeah. Well, it shouldn't be the case with the Army. I didn't know that about Wackenhut. Thanks a lot. So they actually have guys bring their own tasers and their own batons. I guess you can equip yourself as however you want.
It's called security on the cheap.
Yeah.
You know, and what happens then is, of course, the more fringe elements that get involved in this kind of security come strapped as though they're, you know, patent, getting ready to go invade Italy.
Well, that's it. It leaves it, you know, there's no groupthink on that, in the sense that you got guys showing up with, like, you know, bazookas and, you know, with, you know, 13 grenades, and the other guy that's just got a, you know, a Leatherman tool.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Because people will go as far as you'll let them.
Yeah.
Incredible.
But it shouldn't be that way with the Army, and that's what we were talking about before, and that's what I asked you, is that, you know, a lot of this stuff is just about cutting corners, you know, and when it comes to people's lives, that shouldn't be the policy of the best army in the world, now should it?
No, it shouldn't. This is Donald Rumsfeld's Army on the Cheap. He's been promoting this for years, and now it's coming true. And American soldiers are paying. Mark, when we come back, we got an interpreter coming in. He is interpreter for Bush, Gore, Clinton, and Cheney. And he says the Bush administration is too secret about too many things. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Yes, we are.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. Tomorrow we'll be talking to Congressman Gerald Nadler for the second time. I guess we talked to him about 3 or 4 weeks ago to see what's going on with the congressional appeal to the Government Accounting Office around these election reforms issues. Right now, since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. And luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone, once again, is Planet Bush correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. God's got a juicer, and he's going to squeeze the sin right out of you.
Okay.
And the pump.
Okay. First, I just want to say thanks for coming to Boston. That was pretty interesting. A lot of people were excited to see you. People were asking me where you were from. It was great.
Well, that was a horrifying experience, Mark. It took me 4 hours and a whole can of Ajax to scrub off the taint of Massachusetts liberal.
Oh, come on.
Deeply unclean, immoral experience,
come
Mark.
On.
I could definitely taste some gay in the water.
Oh, you're out of your mind.
Tasted gay.
You got over it, didn't you, Lawton? All right,
I suppose.
All right, listen. This morning we're going to talk about church and state.
Church, Mark.
Okay, right.
State
right.
And church emerge. Church.
Okay,
you'll
all right.
Get used to that word before long. Church. Yeah, that word's right there on the Ten Commandments.
Church is not on the Ten Commandments. You're out of your
you
mind.
Use the word,
right, and hey, all right, I got an 11th commandment for you. Thou shalt not display the Ten Commandments on government property. How about that?
Mark, if this church doesn't display the Ten Commandments in public schools or courthouses, where are we going to put them?
Well, how about just off the top of my head, how about church? How about that? In church?
You're missing the big picture, buddy. When people are contemplating a public monument displaying the Ten Commandments, it keeps them from having public gay sex.
What are you talking
about?
It's
like throwing a bucket of cold water on folks. It's not like that Charlton Heston movie, The Ten Commandments, which I understand is a big favorite among homosexuals. You know, Vernon Bush, Yul Brynner, all
right,
that.
Okay, all right. But half of the Ten Commandments aren't even about morality, all right? Stop that. They're rules of religious worship, not the basis for laws. You understand? Thou shalt not worship any other god, make a graven image, say the Lord's name in vain, break the Sabbath, dishonor parents. You can't get arrested for any of those things, buddy.
Well, not yet, no. A newly appointed Bush Supreme Court's going to change all that. You can just relax.
Oh, wait, listen to me. Church. Unfortunately, you may have a point. Right?
Yay.
That's sad. But here's my point. As long as most of these commandments aren't even laws, why should we hang them on public walls as if they were Christmas decorations?
Well, okay, because the Ten Commandments remind us of the deeper meaning of the holidays. I mean, of course, Christmas is a time for buying material goods on credit for people who don't want or need them, but it's also about shame and sin and moral degradation.
Well, that's a cheery holiday thought.
Well, no, Mark, hang on. That's a cheery Christmas thought, okay? Because Jesus Christ came into the world to remind us that peace on earth the most precious gift of all.
Well, Lawton, I may not agree with you on the Jesus part, but I do agree that right now, considering the state of this world, peace would be the greatest gift this world could. What is it? What's
the I wanted a bicycle.
All right.
All I ever wanted for Christmas was a bicycle.
Okay.
A little boy, shiny red bike.
Okay.
Daddy thought a mechanized vehicle would give me the sin of pride. So
oh.
All I got was socks and underpants.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Used socks and
underpants.
I wanted a red bike with a banana seat and a belt.
All right. It's okay, buddy. It's so sad. It's okay, buddy. See where it all comes from? Oh, see where it comes from. Okay, buddy, let it out. Let it out, man. You all right? Okay. All right. You all right? Okay. All right.
Ten Commandments in public, 20 feet tall.
Oh, no.
Thank you, Sturge.
No. All right, buddy. All right, we'll talk to you later, Lawton. Okay,
God loves you.
All right, thanks for the breakthrough. All right.
Bye-bye.
Wow.
I didn't think he was going to return this time.
Sturge. Can you believe
Sturge? Sturge.
All right, our guest right now is a former State Department interpreter. He has interpreted for Bush, Gore, Clinton, Cheney. He's had 9 years of experience at this level, and he's on our phone right now. Please welcome Fred Burks to the show. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, listeners.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you. So we've read a piece about you, and, you are definitely in the news. And, so why don't you just get right into it and tell us what made you resign as translator after having served with the State Department for 18 years?
Well, basically, they came out with a new clause in our contract. We had to renew our contract that was all about secrecy, and it says that we cannot share any information that we learn by way of our duties for the rest of our lives.
So now, is that's unusual?
Well, yes. It's the degree that we're talking about here. I'm not in the least saying that we don't need any secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we should have secrecy. And in fact, the strange thing was, I never even had secret clearance, and I was interpreting for the president.
So why do you think now, all of a sudden, because of this administration?
It's not necessarily this administration. They started coming out with this back in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, they sent out not a whole new contract, but just a single sheet of paper saying, we would like you to sign this. And it was the same languaging. And at the time, I said, no, this is way too restrictive. And so I didn't send it in, never heard a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible.
And it wasn't until the turn of the fiscal year in the government, which is October 1st this year, that they then sent out a whole new contract with this language in it and said everyone has to sign it.
Wow. Tell us, if you would, Mr. Burks, a bit about Abu Bakr Bashir.
Oh, well, I guess if you read the papers, you may have seen him. He seems to be in the press a lot. Abu Bakr Bashir is the gentleman who is a Muslim cleric claimed to be the head of Jama'a Islamia, which is claimed to be the sort of sister organization of Al-Qaeda in Southeast Asia.
So he's a bad guy.
Yeah, you have to understand that, I spend a lot of time in Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim nation in the world.
Sure.
Over 220 million people there. And a lot of people there question whether Jama'a Islamiyah even exists. And they hold Abu Bakr Bashir very highly in esteem. Many people think he's something, you might think of someone like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson.
Right. Mm-hmm. So he's got a TV show and he has... Does he have a TV show and ask people for money?
I don't watch the Indonesian TV enough, but he certainly has been on Indonesian TV quite a bit.
Now, I sort of want to get into something because this is interesting to me that, so you sit in private meetings with people that speak the languages that you speak and interpret it for the president or the vice president, right?
Correct.
So now, there's an assumption. I mean, it's not just that it surprised me, but you are going to be hearing, everything, or as secret as those type of meetings can be.
Mm-hmm.
Was it just sort of an assumption that you would never, divulge things to the press, or what? Was there conversations that happened around that?
Well, there's not really conversation around the secrecy so much. There's more of an ethical consideration that all interpreters are going to keep things confidential unless there's a really good reason for talking about it.
In general, do you hear things like when you were, working for Cheney, let's say? I mean, are there things said in those type of discourses that you would consider, top secret or possibly, threats to the state of the administration?
Not often.
Mm-hmm.
No, in fact, it's pretty rare.
Mm-hmm.
There are occasionally meetings where, there literally are secret meetings. And I was only involved in one that was really a very top secret meeting where one of the women even admitted to me that she was a CIA agent. That's the first time somebody.
So they used the CIA translators or people from the intelligence community as opposed to the State Department for those type of conversations?
No, in fact, there was no CIA translator or interpreter. Brought me in because they needed someone to have this CIA agent who was claimed to be a special assistant to the president. Of course, they didn't tell.
Well, clearly, there's a tremendous lack of CIA operatives that were able to infiltrate, the Iraqi government or any of the of those sort of situations that was one of the reasons why so much we weren't able to find the information we needed before this horrendous war.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is one of the claims, is there was a huge shortage of Arabic interpreters.
Tell us, if you would, a bit about this secret meeting that took place in 2002 in terms of trying to get Bashir turned over to the United States. This was with Indonesian President Megawati, no?
Right. Well, that was probably the most secret meeting I was involved in. I got a phone call on a Friday, and the woman at the National Security Council, who's the expert on Indonesia, said, hey, can you be with me tomorrow, or can you leave with me tomorrow to go to Indonesia for this special secret meeting? And I said, sure, I was available at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is, she says, you have secret clearance, don't you? And I said, no. And she said, well, can you keep a secret?
Oh, wow. So
that was basically it.
Did you shake on it?
Sorry?
Did you shake on it?
No, it is. That was it. That was the extent of it.
So, okay, let's talk about someone who I'm perversely fascinated with for all for the wrong reasons. Is that not perversely in a sexual way, but just that I think he's one of the human incarnations of evil. And you worked for him, Dick Cheney. What was it like? You know, being next to him. Did you feel your skin burn? Was there any heat coming off of him in any way?
You know, I only spent about 15 minutes with Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
That was just like 8 days after 9/11 in the White House, when Megawati was here and they were trying to make a big deal that here's the leader of the largest Muslim country in the nation and in the world,
mm-hmm.
and we're not trying to exterminate against them. So Cheney did not seem very friendly. He was pretty cold, aloof, and just seemed like he wanted to get the meeting over with. And
It seems to be the general consensus about him, except mm-hmm. for the people that know that sometimes his eyes roll back in his head and he speaks through. All right, anyways. So, Bush, how about working for the president?
Bush could be very friendly. I'll tell you, I tell people he's basically one of the good old boys.
Uh-huh.
And good old boys have a good sense of humor, like to slap each other on the back.
Well, that's clear. What about his grasp of foreign policy?
Well, this was some strange stuff happened around that. Basically, the longest meeting, that wasn't the longest, but a long meeting at right after 9/11 was with Megawati in the White House mm-hmm. for 90 minutes, and he had to talk in detail about Indonesia. And at the time, I said, he did it very well. Not only that, he did it with no notes.
Yeah.
And I said, how is this possible?
Uh-huh.
And it really intrigued me, and at the time, I was sitting there thinking, there's no way I couldn't have done it. And I'm an Indonesian specialist.
Right.
And so I thought, there's one of two things. One is either they're portraying Bush to be stupid and he's actually really smart.
Right.
Or he must be getting Fed's information electronically in some way.
Wow. Yeah, well, that was the idea in the debate, so that, but even
exactly.
That takes a certain amount of skill to, interpret a wire in your head. I know, because I just had some guy talking to my head, and it always throws you off, but I'm certainly not discounting that. It seems to me that he might be one of those people that can, read a page of facts, cram it into his head, and spit it out, within the next hour or so, but it dissipates after that.
I suppose it's possible, but the level he did it at really surprised me. So at the time, this was before the whole debate thing. I eventually made the conclusion that he must be fed stuff wirelessly.
Yeah.
But I don't have proof. I did not see, and I was not looking for any sort of device or anything like that.
Well, it looked like he had something on his back, and a lot of people think he was wired. I mean, that's certainly out there in the ether.
Right.
It's definitely possible. So we got to go, Fred. It was great talking to you.
Great.
There's been no reprisals, have there, against you in any way?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Basically, I resigned, and you know, I got along well with everyone there, and I enjoyed my job. It's
okay.
Just it was much too restrictive, the secrecy clause.
Okay, Fred Burks, thank you very much for being
thank
with
you,
us.
Mark.
You take care. All right, we'll be back in a second. What do we got coming up? You want to take some more calls? Where are we at? Can we?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, let's take some more calls. 866-303-2270 about the election, about Social Security, about secrecy, about, you know, whatever you want. 47 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Call 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Yes, we're back. It's 52 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm with Mark Riley sitting right over there.
Yes, yes. Where?
You're right there. I see you. Let's talk about this real quick. We'll take some calls. We're taking calls at 866-303-2270. But it looks like I hope that Howard Dean is the Democratic National Committee Chair, don't you?
Well, you know, there are eight people that are contesting. And remember, too, that Howard Dean cannot be DNC chair and run for the presidency in 08, something he's talked about doing. But he certainly showed up in Lake Buena Vista, Florida, over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And this was for presentations, 5 minutes each, from the eight people who would be Democratic National Committee chair. One, Leo Hendry, who used to be the boss of the Yes Network here in New York,
uh-huh.
and who was consulted by a friend of both of ours, Jen Bluestein, dropped out of the race.
Yeah.
But there are now eight, former Denver Mayor Wellington Webb, former Texas Representative, actually soon to be former Texas Congressman Martin Frost, who's
yeah.
backed by Barney Frank. Remember,
uh-huh.
he mentioned him on Friday. Simon Rosenberg, Harold Ickes, Donnie Fowler, Jim Blanchard, oh, God, this guy's Ronald Kirk, former mayor of Dallas, and Howard Dean.
And we've got, you know, we've got Eli Pariser coming up. He's the executive director of Move On PAC,
yeah.
Who made the statement about Terry McAuliffe. And the thing I like about Dean is that, you know, he really believes in the core democratic principles. He doesn't believe that we need to change our message. He just believes that we need to reach out more effectively and stay true to who we are.
Yeah. By the way, I misspoke. Kirk's name is Ron Kirk. He was a former mayor of Dallas.
You want to take a call?
Yeah, sure.
Vince in New Jersey, how are you? Listen to WLIB. Good morning, Vince.
Hey, Vince.
What's up?
I have been listening to the efforts to remedy the voting situation. I have this suggestion. I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that there must be a class action lawsuit here for all those individuals, thousands of them, who have been disfranchised by disfranchised by Diebold and other machine companies.
Well, a lot of them were disenfranchised, you know, just by the placement of machines or lack of placement, and the subterfuge is put forth by the people operating the polls and saying or telling them they were at the wrong polling places. There were a lot of things that were going on with that.
Yeah, well, a net to web to gather all of that together, and so not only the machine companies, but also the Republican National Committee, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, maybe someone is looking into that. I don't know of it, but it's a good suggestion. Thank you for calling, Vince.
Thank you for calling. The problem is that the rate Bush is messing with the courts. What court are you going to end up hearing it in where Bush's people aren't going to be there to knock it down?
I guess that's not a reason not to do it. I don't know if one is is actually taking place or not.
I'm not saying not to do it. I'm saying you have to choose your court very carefully. Remember, the Ninth Circuit out on the West Coast is considered to be so liberal, they now want to break it up into three different courts.
Yeah. Let's take a call from James, listening in Atlanta on WWAA. Good morning, James.
Hey, James.
Good morning. How you guys?
We're pretty good, man.
I just wanted to make a comment about the war. I think what we did, we made a very bad mistake exposing our military to the world. And what we do, we continue to refer to the Iraqis like insurgents, thugs, but we're catching hell right now just fighting these guys. Just imagine we had we're fighting an organized military like North Korea.
Yeah.
And so I think what Rumsfeld and these guys did, they don't know the mistake they made by exposing these young boys right here that's, you know, just getting out of high school. And we're catching hell right now. Just imagine we went up against some organized military.
Yeah.
And that's true. And we are fighting really civilians that do not appreciate us occupying and invading their country.
Well, I think
like if somebody came inside your neighborhood right now, what you'd do is you'd do the same thing. You'd duck your head and try to shoot a foreign troops.
Right. Thanks for your call, James. I tend to think that the State Department and Donald Rumsfeld, the Pentagon, they know exactly, you know, what's going on there, and they will not take responsibility for the mistakes that they have made. It's not within their, you know, they will disperse the blame. They will try to blame the victim. They will try to blame the army. They will blame the reporter. They will blame the manufacturers. They will not take responsibility, but they know what's going on there. And they're trying to, you know, cut corners, and they tried to cut corners from the very beginning by not sending the proper amount of troops. They're sending in more troops to buttress the election, to protect the election. But I think they know exactly what they've gotten into. This is not an administration that will take responsibility for anything.
See, his point, though, is interesting, because what he's saying is that the foibles of the American military have now been exposed to the world through the Iraq War. And anyone who might try and take America down or try and fight America now has an advantage, the advantage of having seen what the American military has done in a foreign country in action.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an interesting point also that he makes, is that if we were fighting an organized army, I mean, that was the whole idea at the beginning, just to blast in there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and whatever army they had there certainly was no, you know, match for what we were putting out, but they had no concept of what would happen afterwards. They had no exit strategy. They had no idea that this insurgency would be as strong as it is. And they also, stupidly, didn't realize that the ex-army guys, the Baathists, were going to, you know, continue to fight in the insurgency.
Keep fighting, and that they would make coalition and common cause with former enemies to fight that insurgency. Coming up in the next hour of Morning's Edition, we've got the executive director of Move On PAC. Talk about their vision for a new Democratic leadership. And Jeff Jarvis, the editor of BuzzMachine.com, joins us for our Media Watchdog segment when we roll on here on Air America Radio.
I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, all of you folks, you latent haters, men, children, women, girls, dog people, cat people, fish people, socialists, how are you? Tweakers out there in California, good morning to you all. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
Oh, my God, how am I going to get rid of this damn cat? It's like there's just too many of them, Chris. You hear me? There's just too many of them. What are you eating over there? What is that? That is the...
A burrito.
A breakfast
that's
burrito?
That's a breakfast dude, it's burrito that has taken New York City by storm.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's really a wrap. They call it a burrito, but it's really a wrap.
Man, we're getting into Pashman territory.
It's really
good.
Who do you think told them to get it?
Yeah, Dan Pashman.
Dan Pashman turned him on to this Pashman phenomenon.
I almost went out. Me and Pashman went out in Boston the other night, as I said earlier, to I did a show over Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater. Dunho? A Dunho reunion tour. Stephen Wright came by. He was funny. It was good. It was exciting. Now I'm back in New York. I'm tired a little, Mark.
Why?
Monday, because it's Monday. I'm trying to do the Monday thing. Mondays are hard. I got to readjust to the regular schedule. I got to force myself to go to bed at 8 o'clock, and then, you know, after being having the weekend club scene schedule, going to Maxwell's on Saturday, being defensive and angry with my own ilk. What is that about? What is wrong with me, man?
There's nothing wrong with you, man.
I'd rather perform for it was fun. It was good. You know, I'm just being crazy. I'm being crazy.
Hey, let me tell you something. This has been a most interesting last few days, because I'm really on the train ride back from Boston. I started thinking about some of the things that are going on in terms of the Democratic Party and the different components and the base and all this. And when we come back in New York, I'm not going to start this week, but when we come back in New York, I'm going to start talking about some of these things and some of the things that I think we need to do.
That's a very long tease.
Yeah, that is. Yeah.
Right.
And it's not going to get satisfied anytime soon.
Stay tuned for January 2nd, where Riley's going to...
We'll call a deep tease.
You know it's great deep. That's it. Deep tease. See, who knows the business? I'll tell you, though, I was surprised in Somerville, because both of us were going up there like, you know, I don't know, is it going to be okay? Just like dozens and dozens of, maybe like at any given point in time, there was at least 100 people in that place.
In that place, and three people came at 4:30 in the morning. We're still setting up, You know, the pigeons hadn't even come out of the rafters at the David Square train station, and here's people waiting to get in.
We're kind of, I'm kind of bummed out because on the affiliate station, they've got pictures, but it looks like there were pictures taken at like 10 after 6. And I'm like, don't put those up. Put the ones that were at 7:30, 8 o'clock. You know, people were crawling out of the, just all over the place. It was great. A lot
it was.
Of fans.
It really was.
A lot of people walked away. The lucky owners of Mouse Pad with me and Mark on it.
That was the most popular item of swag we had up there. I'm sorry, swag.
Swag.
Yeah.
Swag.
Swag.
So, I was thrilled. I was actually a little thrown off at the beginning because, first of all that free coffee, and it was strong coffee, was good.
It was good.
Then I had all the coffee cake, right, so I'm jammed.
I fell off the wagon.
Oh, yeah.
Badly.
Believe me, you've got a lot of leeway there, dude. You know, I mean, when it comes to falling off wagons, just realize that, you're still three or four steps away from really falling off and damaging your life. That's a little.
Oh, I know. Believe me,
I know. That's what we call the spectrum of rationalization in the recovery biz.
I know.
That's
I don't right. know you those know people mean? Anymore. Though.
Do yeah. yourself, yeah.
I don't know the people that I used to be, that I used to cop.
Dude, you can find them. Wherever those people were, there's new guys that sprouted there. They just sprout and they look like the old guy eventually. But the spectrum of rationalization is, how many things can I do before I actually get to a point where I'm doing something that'll really hurt me?
Right.
It's a big list, man. And it just happens to be my Christmas list. So, all right. Look. We got our guest on the phone. Let's not waste any more time with my self-indulgent noodling. How about that? Let's talk to this guy because, we talked to Barney Frank about something he said, and he is the... what am I trying to say?
Executive director.
Yes, he's the executive director of Move On Pack. He is Eli Pariser. Good morning, Eli.
Good morning.
How
morning,
are you doing?
It's a good morning here.
Okay. Where are you exactly?
I'm in New York also.
Oh, okay. You're here with us.
But I looked outside the window. It's a little gray. It looks like it's going to rain. So you're lying a little bit.
I'm in a good mood.
Oh, good. Well, good.
There you go.
So let's talk about the future of the Democratic Party. What do we need to do? Do you agree with Dean? We don't need to change much. What do we need to do?
Well, I think, I think we need to bring the inside, the outside in.
Okay.
We need to take all of this incredible passion, and the hard work and dedication and the new people that we saw in this cycle, people who had never been involved in politics before, but who decided to stand up and get involved, and we need to engage them in the party and make sure that they're an important part of deciding where the party goes from here. I think it's been an insider team for too long,
right?
And it's time to bring some of these people who really have passion for what the party means and what it stands for into, the process of making these decisions, like the one about the DNC chair.
Well, do me a favor. In your mind, give me a few sort of bullet points of what you think the Democratic Party stands for. Can you do that?
Sure. I mean, basically, I think it stands for people against big, powerful corporations and special interests and the very wealthy. It stands for regular people, and that's been the tradition that it's been in for decades, if not this whole century, and it's a proud tradition. I think that's when people vote Democratic, it's because they believe the Democrats will stand up for them against the corporate interests.
Uh-huh.
I think the party has drifted from that in some ways, and it's time to return to that bedrock that people find so meaningful.
What about social programs, reaching out to the people that can't help themselves, some of the liberal ideals? Do you think there's still room for those within the Democratic Party?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think the core belief in the Democratic Party is that if you're unlucky, that you shouldn't be, you shouldn't be thrown out on the street, that there should be a safety net, that, helps people, just enough that they can, make a life for themselves and help others.
Now, in your piece, the piece that was written on you in the Associated Press, if I can quote you, for years the party has been led by elite Washington insiders who are closer to corporate lobbyists than they are to the Democratic base, but we can't afford four more years of leadership by consulting class and professional election losers. That's pretty tough stuff.
Right, well, I think it's time, you know, it's time to clean house.
And I shared that in a rephrasing with Barney Frank. Can I play that for you, Eli?
Sure.
All right, here's Barney Frank from Morning Edition in Somerville last Friday.
That is terribly unfair and counterproductive. I don't understand why they would say that. In the first place, he's not going to be the chairman after this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why people think they have to kind of, you know, we talk about divisiveness and demonization. That goes two ways.
Yeah.
They ought to be able to disagree honestly with people. The notion that, what did you say, they drove the Democrats?
Well, they just said that it was because of him selling out the party to corporate interests that, you know, that he was partly responsible for the loss.
Oh, I think that is gibberish.
So, Eli, we're going to have you respond to that when we come back. We're talking to Eli Pariser from Move On Pack. It's 14 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less on Air America Radio.
Team past the hour, it's Mark Maron. I'm here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mark. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We have Eli Pariser on the phone. Right now, I am going to do the Palm Pilot that was delivered to me by Ramon in a sweatsuit. This is, I guess, in response to the president's physical, where it was found out that he was a little bit overweight, which, you know, really affects a self-centered, narcissistic, vain person like the president, who I'm sure from here on out will be solely obsessed with that as... will be witnessed here by his Palm Pilot and schedule for today. 6 a.m. wake up, immediately step on scales, 199.6 pounds, too many campaign donuts. I'm hideous. No one will love me now. 6:30 a.m., breakfast, laxative omelet and Diet Coke.
Ooh.
6:45 a.m., 7:45 a.m., bathroom time. I'm hideous. No one will love me now. 7:50 a.m., weigh in, 199.7 pounds. How did that happen? Fire someone. 7:45 a.m. Purge. Note. I wonder if I can still fit into that flight suit. 7:55 a.m. Burn flight suit. 10 a.m. Call Putin about Ukrainian election crisis. Note. He's so thin. How does he do it? 10:15 a.m. Purge. 1 p.m. Find some excuse to meet with Colin Powell just to feel better about my weight. 2 to 9 p.m. Jog on treadmill in steam room. Declare war on donuts. 9:10 p.m. Purge. Weigh in. 199.8 pounds. Oh, no. I'm hideous. No one will love me now. Eli, I've given you plenty of time to respond to Barney Frank saying it's gibberish. What do you think?
Well, I just think, you know, he's wrong. The point of our message was that the DNC is not doing enough to engage the grassroots, and I think that's absolutely true. And, you only have to look as far as the DNC process. I mean, you know, here's this incredibly closed process where these 440 DNC members, you know, basically make a decision without any input, without any, you know, query of the grassroots. And I think that's wrong. I think as the leader of the Democratic Party for the next 4 years, you know, that there should be some way of reaching out to the grassroots, and if Terry McAuliffe isn't going to do it, then we are.
Right.
And, you know, that was the purpose of the message.
Who do you support for this?
Well, we're not supporting, I mean, you know, I would never go out and say I'm supporting this candidate or that candidate because, you know, I really see myself as someone who's serving our members to figure out which candidates our members support. But right now we're not supporting any particular candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Eli, you take issue with the notion that guys like Terry McAuliffe have to exist in the Democratic Party specifically in order to raise money. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, the operating mode for Democratic politics and for Republican politics, too, by the way, has been basically that you raise a lot of money from wealthy donors. And that you put that money into making ads, and you never actually have to talk to real people. You don't have to have them volunteer. You don't have to have them give money. It's all, you know, it's all this closed loop, and that poisons the environment that you're working in. It makes it hard to remember what you're fighting for. And what's happening now, which is really exciting, is that, you know, for this year, hundreds of thousands of new donors came in and wrote those $15 and those $25 checks, and it added up into something pretty huge. It added up into hundreds of millions of dollars. And so now, for the first time, the party doesn't have to go to those wealthy contributors. It can go directly to the people that it's fighting for, present its case, and say, "Well, you help us fight, for these values." And I think that's a more compelling, a more pure, and ultimately a more effective way of winning.
Now, Eli, it's February. Let's pretend for a minute it's February. And they're getting ready to meet to pick the Democratic National Committee chair. What in that process would make you believe that your message, Move On PAC's message, has in fact been heard? What is there something that will be done in February that would make you say, okay, they heard me?
Well, I would love to see the party as an apparatus reach out to its constituents in the course of this process. And if they do that, then I will be a much happier camper.
Who would be their constituents? Who would they have to reach out to specifically?
Well, look, the DNC has a multi-million person email list. They could send out a message that says, here's who's running, tell us what you think. And that would be a good start. That would be a good start, to begin this process.
I get their emails, Eli, and yours are much more exciting.
Yes.
Oh, well, thanks. But that doesn't mean they couldn't do it.
No, I know, but you constantly get this feeling.
Doesn't mean they couldn't do it.
No, I know, but you constantly get this feeling with the Democratic Party and with the people they choose, that they're just so frightened, that they're frightened to alienate anybody, and then by doing that, they don't really say anything.
Right, and you think that they don't know that there are 54 million people out there who totally agree with them. And I think that the lack of courage, the wimpiness, comes from being locked inside the Beltway, where you're not in touch with those people, where you don't see them and you don't understand how strong they are and how passionate they are and how they'll have your back if you go out and do something courageous.
But it's very interesting that, they have people within the party that, that they have, people within politics. I mean, we were up in Somerville, Massachusetts. We talked to the mayor there, Joe Curtatone, who is a very, congenial, outgoing person that really speaks for his constituents. We've got people like Barney Frank. You got people like Barack Obama. You got people coming in at local government. It seems like they don't put enough attention on the people that are coming up from the bottom areas in the local government to really sort of start getting behind them and showcasing their abilities to reach out to people.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that's one of the big places where the parties drop the balls in cultivating local leadership and local talent, so that 5-10 years down the line, the people who are running for school board now can be running for senator.
Right.
And that's another place where I think the party absolutely has to focus if it's going to be effective.
Mm-hmm. Eli, by dogging Terry McAuliffe, you have, I guess, by inference, dogged the Bill Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. Do you see that wing as being in decline or in eclipse on some level? Do you think that the former president, should have as much influence, perhaps, on the 08 election as he did on the 04?
Well, basically, I think that this is an inside versus outside thing. I keep saying this, but really, it's there's a group of people who have been in Washington for a long time, and when you're there, there's a set of ideas about how what's possible and what's not possible that you come to believe is absolutely true, and that's why we need to bring some people who haven't been in that environment for so long. I think the not fighting strategy has not worked. The let's find some middle ground strategy has not worked, and it's time for Democrats to stand up for the progressive values that we all believe in, for community, for respect, and for freedom. And
reason and truth.
And reason and truth. Exactly.
Yeah.
And speak about those values in a way that engages the whole country. I think that's possible, but I think you have to start by articulating the things that you really believe at the core of your party. And
we've got to do that.
Drifted from that.
And we're going to do it with your help. Eli Pariser, thank you for joining us.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, Eli.
Nice to talk to you. That was Eli Pariser, Executive Director of Move On PAC.
All right, coming up, the editor of BuzzMachine.com joins us for our Media Watchdog segment. We're going to find out why some stories of the week get covered and some stories do not, including a really interesting exchange that happened on cable TV when we come back here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Hey, we're back. 34 past the hour. Air America Radio, Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley there.
Hi.
Right now, you know, look, we know things are tough in the job market, and so we've decided to help out. We scanned through the Help Wanted listings and found this for our Morning's Edition Monday job listing.
I hope.
National Director of Intelligence. Do you enjoy getting blamed for things? With the passage of the Intelligence Reform Bill, an immediate opening has been created for a National Director of Intelligence. Because this is a new position, the nature of the job depends to a large degree on the initiative of the person who first fills it. In one person's hands, this post can really be a sop to families of 9/11 victims and an annoyance to the Pentagon. But a more enterprising individual can turn this position into a threat to the civil liberties of every single American. The challenges are real. For instance, you will be responsible for translating millions of bits of information, much of it in Arabic, for a nation where most of the people who speak Arabic are on watch lists. Oh, and the one other thing. You will be responsible for imparting intelligence to the president. Intelligence to the president. It is vitally important that you never acknowledge the irony in that. Our guest in studio. No.
Wow, close though.
I know. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it don't. That would be a reference to throwing the little wadded up piece of paper in the garbage.
It was a big wadded up piece of paper, even so you missed. But
yeah, well,
it's okay.
But it had sort of
I don't want to ruin the mystery of radio here.
It had like a broken wing though. I didn't know it properly.
2 feet away. But I don't want to break down the wall of the studio here.
I'm sorry we don't have time for our guest, but I appreciate you coming down. It was great.
Nice to see you.
I'm glad you got all dressed up for that. Anyways, our guest in the studio right now is Jeff Jarvis. He's the editor of BuzzMachine.com. He's former TV critic and for TV Guide and People. He's also the creator of Entertainment Weekly. And he was also the writer and the finder of that information about the Parents Television Council, which is one of the Christo-fascist zombie brigades for the neocon death cult. Yes.
Prigs, prudes, and bozos who are trying to keep us from watching what we want to watch.
That's
and
right.
To what we want to listen to.
Will you encapsulate that really quickly, that story from last week?
It was real quick. I saw that the FCC put its largest fine in history, $1.2 million, against Married by America because of complaints of a mere 159 Americans, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
I filed a Freedom of Information request, which anybody can do,
mm-hmm.
bloggers, journalists, whatever, anybody should have done, and said, I want to see who complained. When I got it, they admitted they only had 90, and they only came from 23 people. And then when I looked into it, I saw that only all but two were identical. They all came from the Parents Television Council complaint factory.
So these are emails email petitions mailed to the members of the Parents Television Council or the mailing list that they have, and then they just sort of like, if you want to be part of this, hit send, put your name on it.
It's even easier. You go to a web page, you put in your name or a fake name, and you hit send, and that's it.
So this is the illusion. This is part of their propaganda.
This is like Beau Jest, the three soldiers in the fort put up 200 helmets on sticks by the walls and look bigger than they are.
Good analogy.
And what it really says is bigger than that. First, is the SEC is going after free speech.
Right.
But secondly, what it says is the Moral Values Army is a load of crap.
Good.
They have not been taken over by a Moral Values Army. It's three guys with 200 helmets.
But I'll tell you what Bill Donahue said on Scarsborough Country, that wasn't a load of crap. That is the real heart and soul of a type of hatred and a type of religiously justified hatred by certain religious people that really needs to be investigated.
The single most, if we're going to talk about media watchdog of the week, we're going to start growling now.
Okay. We have that, but we need something else, but I'll throw it to you. I'll give him a little one.
Oh, good, good.
There you go.
So it's radio. The growl of the week is the most disgusting, despicable, horrible moment on media all week was MSNBC's Scarborough report with, hey, he's gone, who am I going to pick to replace him?
Mm-hmm.
Pat Buchanan.
Right.
Who else?
And then they have a show about a made-up war between the idea that, well, Hollywood is gonna award Michael Moore, and they're not going to award Passion of the Christ. And so Hollywood is evil. Right? Mm-hmm. That was the shtick. Mm-hmm. They have on, the first sin is the Bookers have on the most obnoxious people they can find, Basically, it's three right-wing rabid dogs against Rabbi Shmuley Botiak, who's not exactly a great friend anyway.
Yeah,
let's gang up on the token Jew.
Yeah, Michael Jackson's homie, isn't it?
Yes. Right. So then Bill Donahue, the head of the Catholic League, whatever that is, says, and I quote, "Who really cares what Hollywood thinks?" Mind you, I'm quoting him.
Yeah.
All these hacks come out there. Hollywood is controlled by secular Jews who hate Christianity in general, Catholicism in particular. It's not a secret, okay? And I'm not afraid to say it. That's why they hate this movie. It's about Jesus Christ. It's about truth. It's about the Messiah. Hollywood likes anal sex.
Wow, where did that come from? Just out of nowhere, there's a perfectly reasonable tirade about how myself being a secular Jew, how we run Hollywood. I'm surprised I have time to do this, but but all of a sudden, out of nowhere, anal sex. Which how did that trigger in his head?
Private life. And it also says that they—that's
you—yes,
like to see the public square without nativity scenes. I, says Donahue, like families. I like children. They like abortions.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was disgusting in so many ways. It was also disgusting because the host of the show didn't say, "Well, don't you think I was a little strong there, Bill?"
Yeah.
You know?
Gee, you're a little out there, aren't you?
Yeah, but of course it's Pat Buchanan, so he only eggs him on. And
right.
It turns into the usual cable screaming match, but it was the lowest screaming match I've seen in ages. And I was sitting in a hotel room with not many channels, and so I had it on by chance, and it took me aback. Andrew Sullivan on his blog quoted it as well this week. The transcript, thank you, was up. It is frightening reading from MSNBC. So
especially because The Passion of the Christ was a crappy movie.
Well, and an anti-Semitic movie. That's the whole point of this.
It's an anti-Semitic movie.
In many views it is, and I agree with that view of it. First, it was a crappy movie, yes.
Yeah.
So the whole pretext of the show was wrong.
Yeah.
Hollywood is against God. The whole way it was booked was wrong. Let's get on the most ridiculous hotheads we can.
There's
a Muslim woman who sides with the American right, which is all kinds of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, or Hindu, I can't remember which it was. I apologize.
That's okay.
And then we go after, Rabbi Shmuley, who's not exactly the
representative. Well, it's just weird that they get, that they use this sort of, this type of anti-Semitism, this idea that it just re-sparks something, this mythic. It's a mythic anti-Semitism, this idea about the Jews killing Jesus and then, us being, we're killing him again. I think they should blame Mel Gibson. I mean, he's the one who killed them over and over again and made $450 million doing He made $500 million on the back of Christ. Now, look, as a Jew, I'm not saying we didn't have anything to do with it, but I will say that
All right, haul him off now. We finally found our guy.
But let me tell you,
Bernie Kerik to arrest you.
That's a good transition. Now, what about Bernie Kerik? You must have some media analysis of that guy on TV.
Now, that was an amazing little. It's the problem of glass houses and nominations. Bernie Kerik gets nominated. Mm-hmm. I was no fan of Tom Ridge and his Geranimals strategy for Homeland Security.
Yes.
So, to me, get a cop in there, all right, so he's a fan of Bush. Of course he is.
Yeah.
Bernie Kerik, okay, he's a cop.
Yeah.
But on the one hand, you have the lionization of Bernie Kerik. Let's salute Bernie. On the other hand, in the other media, you have, there's got to be something wrong with him, but nobody knew what.
They didn't have to dig too deep.
No, let me tell you something. A lot of people knew, but they didn't have the hard evidence. This reminds me so much of the situation with Jim McGreevy and Golan Cypel, where you have somebody that is sponsored by someone, gets a highly sensitive job, mm-hmm. and suddenly watches their entire career implode before their very eyes. It was an incredible And the interesting thing is a lot of media people say, well, gee, didn't they know about this? Or didn't they know about this? And now the Daily News got a front page story. It says the guy was catting around.
But that's just the point about media. I was the dumbest person in New Jersey. I didn't know about the governor.
Really?
Clueless. I live in New Jersey. I didn't know. But I asked all kinds of media people, and I have friends, and I said, did you know this?
Yeah,
they knew, why didn't we know something? And the same here. Now, on the other hand, so absolutely, the man who's running Homeland Security over immigration, having an immigration problem, doesn't wash.
Strikeout.
On the other hand, so he has a sex life. Howard Stern this morning said, pardon me, I couldn't get your signal out where I live, he too wrote a book with Judith Regan, and he said there's a lot of sexual sparks with this woman, and it was in his home when he was still married, so they didn't do anything. But then he had this horrible fear.
Howard just assumed that he could have.
Yeah.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Assumed could have, would have. Yeah. But then his real fear is that she also edited Rush Limbaugh's book.
Yeah.
Whoa. I can't even imagine that.
And who wants those sloppy seconds?
Yeah, really. Well, yeah. You know, the thing is, the whole thing about Carrick supposedly using on-duty New York City police officers to find the cell phone and the necklace that Judith Regan lost.
Supposedly lost, but hadn't in fact lost.
Yeah, hadn't in fact lost. And really grilling some Fox employees about this. Now, you know, Fox, fair and balanced, all of a sudden turn around into the greatest civil libertarians in human history over that.
Well, what happens to a guy? How is this going to impact, you know, Giuliani in the media? How is it going to, I mean, obviously Carrick's a thug, and obviously Giuliani was, you know, the head thug who helped this thug get to where he's going to be. And now how, you know, what does the media have to do to reframe Giuliani as the, you know,
well, I think it started today. You have the front of the New York Times today saying that Giuliani is apologizing to Bush and trying to back up as fast as he can. It's like an old cartoon.
You know, yeah.
He's going back with smoke behind him. You know, and I think he'll be fine. He's still got the halo over him. But, you know, the bigger problem here is if we keep on going into every single foible of everybody. I mean, Clinton was a great president, and he had a sex life, too. Mm-hmm. We're going to end, if we go for nothing but dull and pure people, you're going to end up with Tom Ridge.
Right. Well, out of this characterization of some of these people, let's talk about the responsibility of the media in terms of what happened with that embedded reporter and why he had to go to that length just to get a question to the people that lead this country. When we come back, we're talking to Jeff Jarvis. It's 44 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Courtesy of Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Our guest is Jeff Jarvis. He's the editor of BuzzMachine.com. Go there and look. Now, okay, a couple questions. Right away, you know, people talk about, you know, corporate media, big media, mainstream media as not doing their job, you know, which is obviously true because there's a lot of obstacles, you know, in the path of that, one being, you know, corporate interests, the other being ideological interests, right? So now you get a situation, like we talked to Mick Ware a lot, Michael Ware, and he's an amazing reporter. He's the only guy, he's one out of, you know, a handful of guys that's had the courage to ride with the insurgency, you know, in Iraq and really do some real reporting. And then you got a situation where this Sergeant Joe Wilson? Yeah, Sergeant Wilson is asking Donald Rumsfeld a question that was fed to him by a reporter who was embedded with him. You know, and people were trying to, you know, blame the reporter on something. But the truth of the matter is that that's what the reporter had to do to get a question through to one of the leaders that, you know, is important topic for the people that they
It really reveals the problem with information and freedom of information on both sides in this equation, right? On the one hand, yeah, it's an important story. The story has to get out. You find a way to get it out. The guy did that, and I agree with all that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, two arguments with the reporter. One is he did use the soldier. Now, how much the soldier wanted to be used is really up to the soldier. But at some point, this guy's ass could be grass.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's an issue. That's kind of a, you know, relationship moral issue of him and the soldier. He used the guy. The second is that he then didn't reveal it in his story, and that's way wrong. And the problem in media today, the biggest problem, I think, is a lack of transparency.
Okay.
And rather,
yeah,
right? You know, and that's the real issue. Is the guy should have been honest with at least his readers and said, this is how this came about.
Yeah.
He didn't. He bragged in an email to the newsroom, aren't I the smart reporter, ha ha ha.
Yeah.
And he really should have said, here's how I had to get the information. Then it would have been a good story.
Right. He should have revealed it as a conversation that he had with, you know, maybe a few Marines about this topic. And, you know, maybe, you know, perhaps he, you know, suggested to the Tom Wilson was his name, not Joe Wilson. Joe Wilson, of course, being the ex-ambassador.
Yeah.
So now, what? How do you think that, you know, this administration, somebody like Rumsfeld, do you see a pattern of sort of, you know, not taking responsibility, blame dispersal? They seem to be really brilliant at subterfuge and just, you know, letting things dissipate.
I look at it media. I think that it's the buzzword of the age is transparency.
Okay.
And what we're talking about is more information. You know, one way or the other, we simply don't have enough armored vehicles over there, right? Well, whatever the blame is, let's get more of them. Right. Let's solve the friggin' problem.
Right.
And that's not what's happening. So if there's this running around trying to hide who did what where, we're not dealing with the real problem.
Well, let's talk about Dan Rather for a second and just the integrity of information. And we live in an over-informatized world to some degree. And the amount of phishing and searching and parsing one has to do just on an individual basis, you know, it's very complicated. Now, what about the integrity of information? How does the media check itself for information?
Well, we all have a new benefit now, which is I don't want to become a blogger triumphalist, but you have the citizens and citizens media out there willing to help you.
Yeah.
What Dan Rather should have said when he got caught 18 minutes after his broadcast with, gee, this looks suspicious, he should have said, thanks. I want to get to the truth, too. Instead, he waited 12 days to say anything.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's the lack of transparency. That's a feeling that the media is the priesthood. Well, it's not. Everybody knows stuff. Right? People can know stuff. A soldier can ask a question to get to the news. I can file a Freedom of Information request to get to the news. Bloggers can fact-check Dan Rather's ass.
It's also a fear of him showing himself to be human and fallible.
He built himself a pedestal, and he didn't build stairs back then.
Yeah, but you know what? We talked to Jim Moore, who works. He's been reporting from Texas for years.
Yeah.
And something he said that struck me was that Texas journalists knew that the alleged source of Rather's information was suspect from the beginning, and
right.
Rather never checked. That there was, just like with Bernie Kerik, there were a lot of people who knew but didn't say anything,
exactly.
Or at least were not asked.
Well, now here's the next chapter. This is the story coming up for next week that we'll watch next, is CBS has the commission looking into this,
mm-hmm.
and the report's about ready to come out, and a site that's been dogging this called ratherbias.com, which is going to be unemployed pretty soon, I imagine, has been saying that there's a big debate going on with inside CBS, and I know part of this myself, as to how to release this, and the question is, how much are they going to release, and will they release the whole thing?
About what?
About the whole investigation of Rathergate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, should CBS learn its bloody lesson, mm-hmm. be transparent now, if ever. Open up all your drawers and show us all what happened there and let us in. That's what media demands, that the people we cover are transparent, yet we aren't transparent ourselves.
But
CBS
needs
to do this.
I mean, if transparency doesn't hurt your cash flow, or I put it this way, if transparency doesn't help your cash flow, why do it?
Because at some point you're going to lose your credibility, and that is your only asset.
Yeah, but what do you see is who has the credibility now? I mean, they're now telling Brian Williams, is that the new guy?
Yeah,
they're not telling him to crack a few more jokes.
Well, network. I sat next to Garrick Utley, a legendary NBC correspondent,
sure.
some thing last week by chance, right?
Yeah,
and you know he's an old guy in media. He gets it. He says that 10 years ago, network news basically saw its last.
They sold itself out. They sold themselves out.
Well, and a whole new competition is coming along, and the world is changing. It's not a world of one-size-fits-all news media anymore. That era is over.
Right.
And so you're going to get what you want, when you want it, where you want it, and we have more control. We, the people, have more control. Fist up in air.
There you go. But there's also when all the people, have the control, it's very easy to get, falsehoods out there, too. It's very easy to start, gossip momentum.
But I find in this new world, things get fact-checked real fast.
Right.
The audience fact-checked Dan Rather in 18 and a half minutes.
Yeah.
So I think that gives me hope. Sure, there are bozos and liars everywhere, in media, out of media, everywhere. But the point is, now that we have this mechanism of the web, the truth tends to gather like white blood cells on bacteria.
Was that story totally discredited?
I can't even remember all details because the story became Rather. No, it wasn't totally discredited. But, on the other hand, the mudslinging, my stance on my blog, buzzmachine.com plug, was that I didn't care about either Kerry's or Rather's Kerry or Bush's,
right.
because I cared about the future more. That the campaign got way too mixed up in this mudslinging.
Now, let's talk about Rather's future. Does he get the big send-off that Brokaw got? Is this going to, is this going to rain on his parade? Is he going to have to walk away in shame? Because he did a lot of great work for a long time.
I think he'll give himself that send-off, but I think it inevitably draws like a magnet all the yes buts you can imagine.
Well, you don't think CBS is going to give him the tribute that he deserves?
They kind of have to,
okay.
but it's going to bring out everybody with every little what's the frequency, Kenneth, moment in his career.
Right.
And I think that's what's going to be. And, that's not a bad thing. He's just human. It's an absurd view. All he does is read for a living.
Right.
You actually talk and think for a living.
Yeah, we try.
Sometimes.
Dan Rather and Barry Bonds.
Yeah.
Tainted together.
Well, I just
Bernie Kerik.
And also, just like you said, it's going to open the door not just for critics, but it's going to open the door for the right-wing propagandists to keep taking hits at him now that they see him as down. And that's going to go out into the blogosphere as well.
Yep.
Well, thanks a lot, Jeff Jarvis. It's great talking to you. I hope
we'll
do
really
this again
great.
Real soon.
Appreciate it.
Very engaging. The website is buzzmachine.com, and that's Jeff Jarvis. Thanks.
Thank you.
There's our facts from the Streisand's compound. Here's our liberal agenda for today. Please, write these down, folks. One, new nicknames for Bush. Commander in Cheese, Engorge Bush, and Blub Ya. Anything? Nothing? Right. Two, participate in Living Nativity Scene as Joseph and Mary's brother-in-law, Ricky, from Sherman Oaks. Three, secretly replace Nero's plaque of Ten Commandments with George Carlin's seven words you can't say on television. Four, hire Ocean's 12 to steal enough money to repay the deficit. That's the next movie. Five, today's phrase is drop it into conversation. Hey, Bush, when's the baby due, huh, Porky? I didn't know Taft was still president because he was fat.
Oh, man. You're hard on our president, man. You're a hard guy.
I know.
Coming up on tomorrow's Morning Edition, Congressman Gerald Nadler gives us an update on that GAO investigation into voting machine inaccuracies, and we've got comedian Mike Birbiglia in studio as well. Have a good one, man. You take care.
You too, Riley.